Sustaining the Earth, Handling Heredity. Two conversations about science and culture, next on Soundings. Hello, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. First on Soundings this week, environmental scientist Thomas Malone provides an optimistic overview of Earth Summit 92. Later on the show, science historian Richard Burian talks about handling heredity, his study of French culture and the practice of biology. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated. Last summer in Rio de Janeiro, Earth Summit 92 brought together leaders of dozens of governments, representatives of industry, and concerned citizens. Topping their agenda were discussions about the quality of life on planet Earth and sustainable development, that is, achieving a way of life that meets the needs of present generations without foreclosing the options of future generations. Among the conference goers was Thomas Malone, distinguished university scholar at North Carolina State University and director of the Sigma Xi Center, the National Scientific Honorary Organization. I asked Tom Malone to reflect on the goals of Earth Summit 92 and to talk about who's in charge of implementing them.
Wayne, the concept that answers the question, who's in charge, was resolved in Rio by the continual use of the word partnership. Huh. In other words, no one is in charge. We're all in charge. And the thrust of the Rio conference was to put in place, and this is a quote, a new form of global partnership, north, south, east, west, scientists, government people, business and industry.
All right, now again, that sounds very noble, but the term moral showdown turns up here in one of the summaries of, that is to say, a prospectus for this Rio meeting in June of 92. Somebody's going to lose, somebody's going to win. Is that too harsh?
That is too harsh. It's a win-win situation, not a win-lose situation. If there weren't some hope at that, do you think there'd be any chance of bringing 140 heads of state or government together to spend 12 days? And then the most interesting part was there was a picture that came out in the daily papers in Rio of 104 of those heads of state all gathered together in one spot, brought together by a common concern over the future of humanity, the human prospect, if you will.
What about the business community, Tom Malone? The business people are traditionally painted as the villains when it comes to the interaction between humankind and the environment. Is that sort of stigma going to continue, soften, what?
Wayne, surprising to many people, but not to me, was that the most imaginative and forward-looking document in Rio was the report of the Business Council on Sustainable Development. 48 CEOs from all over the world got together and said, look, the integration of issues of environment and development are our business, too. We have a responsibility, we have a vital role to play, and we're going to play it. So that in Rio, the business industry community wore a distinctly white hat.
What is the United States' role in this grand scenario that you are painting for us, Tom Malone? Traditionally, the USA has been the leader in technological development. Are we going to be, how will we lead, or will we end up following?
I think and hope that we will be leading, and I'm convinced that perhaps we will. But we're going to have to discern a new mode of leadership. It's not going to be economic might or military might as it has been in past decades. It's going to be an interaction with our partners in the industrial world and in the developing countries. And let me cite a specific example. The United States, through its Office of Science, Technology, Policy that Dr. Alan Bromley chairs, has been successful in establishing an Inter-American Institute for Global Change Research. That means that a mechanism has been put in place to unify the efforts and the interests of both North and South America to lay the groundwork for knowledge generation, integration, and policy formulation. It's a very modest step, but it is the kind of innovative approach which we're going to have to invent to meet the challenges of a profoundly more interdependent world.
Would you say that science, the development, human progress, for lack of a better term, does it pose the threat that some of the doomsayers seem to tell us that it does to the environment?
No, I don't think it does. But that threat will be, there is a threat, of course. That threat will be contained if there is established a more intimate interaction with scholars in science and technology and scholars in human behavior and human values.
We're about to elect a president, Tom Malone. Is the environment a partisan issue? Does it have to be? You're a scientist. How do you look at it in those terms?
Wayne, this brings to mind again this precious word partnership. And the concept of partnership is inimical with political confrontation. If we let this crucial issue of the human prospect become a football of politics during this year's elections and subsequent elections, we will have set back the hands of progress.
Tom, you used the word progress. Let me challenge you again. Before our taping here, you sent me some information about the Earth Summit 92. And you have a little table here. What happened during the 12 days of UNCED in Rio? It looks pretty awful. I mean, if this is the kind of thing, the world's population increasing, children dying, species disappearing, if this occurred over the period of 12 days when this conference was going on, are we racing the clock in a race here that essentially we're going to lose?
No, I don't think so, Wayne. The important thing is to recognize these problems. If we go on our merry way proclaiming that we're all standing tall, that the world is doing great, disregarding those problems, then catastrophe is inevitable. If we recognize, identify, and set down those problems, and then put in place strategic plans for addressing them, then we have some hope.
What kinds of specific things should citizens think about? I mean, the people in my neighborhood, for example, are keenly aware of recycling. There is, I think it's fair to say, a certain amount of consciousness raising that has worked over the past 20 years or so. Are there particular points that you as a scientist would pass on to the average citizen?
I wish there were a magic bullet or two that it penetrated our minds, our consciousness would solve all these problems. Fundamentally, the issues before us require two things. One is a change in the way of thinking, a complete change in the way of thinking. Remember Albert Einstein, on the advent of the nuclear age, said, "Everything in the world has changed except our way of thinking." And now we have to change the way of thinking. For example, we have to stop worshiping the altar of economic growth and recognize that development is really human development. Economic development is a part of it. But human development means making possible achieving the aspirations, the total aspirations, not just economic aspirations. That's one of the kind of things that we have to do. And the second is to refashion our institutions, which have grown up in a disciplinary, compartmentalized mode, which is quite successful in extending knowledge, but woefully inadequate in integrating knowledge. And it's integrating knowledge that is going to be the key.
Tom, is it, to challenge you for a moment here, is it self-serving for you to talk about this the way you were talking about it, to be so optimistic? You are, after all, part of a scholarly scientific community that has a very large stake here in convincing the public to think positively, favorably, about what's going on in efforts such as the Rio meeting in June of 92.
Wayne, I hope my strong plea for a more intimate interaction, a partnership of scientists, politicians, business leaders, and the general public puts at rest any notion of arrogance or self-serving that might be interpreted from my enthusiasm for getting on with the task. Uh-huh. The scientists are not going to solve all these problems. We're only going to address them together. And if anything, I'm talking about lowering any notion of elitism in the scientific community and integrating that with the rest of human activity.
Tom Malone, be brief for me. What was the most important thing, in your mind, the item of greatest significance that occurred at Earth Summit 92 in Rio de Janeiro?
Wayne, it was not the Treaty on Climate Change. It was not the Treaty on Biodiversity. It was not the 115 program areas in the agenda for the next century. It was this, that for the first time in recent history, the leaders of more than 100 nations came together and reached agreement on a set of working principles by which the issues of environmental quality and economic development could be reconciled, and accepted, in principle, a framework of things that needed to be done during the next 10 years to ensure an attractive human prospect during the 21st century. It was a start of a process rather than a discrete outcome that was the most significant feature of Rio de Janeiro.
Tom Malone, I want to thank you for your contribution to Soundings. You are a distinguished university scholar at North Carolina State University and director of the Sigma Xi Center here in Research Triangle Park. Thanks for coming by the National Humanities Center.
Thanks for inviting me here, Wayne. I've been an ardent listener and great admirer of this series, and you and the National Humanities Center are to be congratulated on bringing this kind of message to the American public.
You're listening to Soundings, a weekly magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Handling heredity. Join me now for a conversation about the interplay of science and culture. I'll talk with Richard Burian, a philosopher and historian of science who teaches at Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University. Although in the popular conception, science is supposed to be coldly objective, the workings of science are in fact frequently subject to cultural pressures. According to Richard Burian, the study of genetics and the practice of biology in France are good examples. For most modern scientists, that is, notions of heredity were shaped by the evolutionary theories of Charles Darwin and the work of Gregor Mendel, the Austrian monk and founder of genetics. Yet, largely because of cultural circumstances, for nearly 100 years, French genetics differed from genetic science in other countries. Richard Burian is exploring the reasons for this difference in a forthcoming book entitled Handling Heredity. I asked him to explain his interest in the interplay of French science and culture between 1860 and 1960.
Well, one of the things that's interesting is that there's a kind of culture clash in the middle of the 20th century, and we're looking for the roots of that culture clash within science. Hmm. It's a culture clash between people who view heredity from the viewpoint of a physiologist, someone who says, what are the processes? How does this change that? And those who thought that they could understand heredity in terms of the structures that are passed on.
You're telling me that science is not some big, beautiful, monolithic truth with a capital T that stands out there, that we have all sorts of cultural and national pressures that come to bear on it.
Scientists aim at finding truth, all right, perhaps even the truth, but they're asking different questions. They have different techniques. They work in different traditions. And there are problems, very serious problems, of integrating those different viewpoints that arise in that way.
Okay, now let's be a little more specific and concrete here. Let's move back into the 19th century, Dick Burian. Talk to me about French biology and what you have termed Darwin, anti-Darwinian, Mendel, and anti-Mendelian. We got some 50-cent terms here.
Let me first say that part of that work is the work of my colleague Jean Gaillon, who wrote a 1,000-page thesis in France on Darwinism and its reception. Darwinism came in this context particularly to mean, first of all, that there is evolution by descent, mm-hmm. so that organisms in a lineage change over time and can become different. And second of all, that the organisms, that what guides and forms the course of the evolutionary history is natural selection.
Now, are we equating this with a word like determinism? You got to be something because something back there was something like you?
Well, in fact, that's part of the issue. Natural selection as a guide to what would happen depended upon what the environment was like. Mm-hmm. The original evolutionary theory that had some sort of mechanism was 50 years before Darwin was French. It was by a man named Lamarck.
Lamarck.
And Lamarck thought there are two sources of evolutionary change. One is the intrinsic structure of organisms being changed because their needs form what they will do, what they will become.
And the other would be the environment.
And the other would be the environment, which uh-huh. deviated them from what they might otherwise become according to their need to fit their surroundings.
Well, that sounds very commonsensical. Why would the scientists fight about that?
Because Darwin's view denied that. Darwin denied any intrinsic structure that automatically said what organisms would become. He said it was entirely an effect of the environment, but not an effect of the environment that was connected with what the organism wished or sought. Mm-hmm. It was some sort of random change in the organism, and then the environment chose which kind of organisms there would be.
This is why the religious people got so upset with Charles Darwin. How does the name Mendel come into this mix?
Mendel comes into this mix only really at or after 1900. His paper in 1865 was, quote, rediscovered in 1900. In that paper, he said, you can separate into little pieces what happens in an organism that when you hybridize two distinct forms, one or the other of the little pieces, the genes, as we have come to call them, will be inherited from each parent, mm-hmm. and it's an organism that is put together as a mosaic of the effects of these little inherited pieces, which we now call genes.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, the French biologists denied that or contradicted it.
They tended to deny it. Uh-huh. They tended to deny it at least as a full explanation of what an organism is. It might well be right that there were genes that affected something like hair color or eye color or something of that sort. But if you put together little pieces that affect hair color and eye color, you haven't got an organism.
You don't have a complete organ. You don't have an eye or a lip or a nose.
That's right.
All right.
That's
and instead, the French biologists were relying on Lamarck. Have I got this right?
That's right. And the Lamarckian view says there is some program of some sort which, as a whole, guides what the organism wishes to become in some sense, mm-hmm. is semi-fated to become, except as it is made to deviate by the environment.
All right, now we have laid the groundwork for this paradox, this sort of envelope that surrounds the doing of French biology, where there is what would the word be, an insulation, not an ignorance or a negligence, but an insulation from mainstream biology. Tell me how we move from one direction to another.
Well, the insulation is insulation from the mainstream tradition that became genetics. And the French in their work knew what was going on in genetics, but were quite thoroughly convinced that that was not sufficient to give an account of what it was that controlled what an organism became.
Mm-hmm. Is that because they were French? What does nationality have to do here?
Well, it does have something to do with nationality. It has this to do, I think, more than anything else, that there were certain traditions formed. Mm-hmm. There were certain questions which were asked and certain ways of working. The physiologist who worked in the middle of the 19th century, Claude Bernard, sought to find out the regulation and control of various physiological states. And this got connected with what was done in the work of Louis Pasteur and what was done in his institute, the Pasteur Institute, to ask the questions about how you regulate and control what becomes of a cell. Hmm. What happens when you give it different food sources, when the nutrition is changed? What happens when it is given various kinds of insults from the environment?
What you're telling me is that there's a kind of an ideology of science. That is to say, the way one phrases the question, you've mentioned this notion of coming from a tradition. This doesn't make you blind to the truth, but it does load the dice in some fashion.
Yes, that's right. It means it says something about what counts as a good enough answer. Uh-huh. And the dice are loaded that these kinds of answers are better than those. This kind of way of answering a question demonstrates it sufficiently, and that kind doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Now, the transition from French biology, what, insulated, as it were, to mainstream, this is a complex process. See if you can flesh that in for me.
Well, it's very complex indeed. It's going to be a little hard to do it briefly. The main point of interest is that by about the time of World War II, Mendelian genetics had always been committed to the idea that it needed to know how genes work, but it didn't have any good techniques for doing that. By about the time of World War II, biochemistry was beginning to reach the point where one could ask the question, what biochemical changes are correlated with the genes? Mm-hmm. That's the time when the French, who had been working on questions about what happens with nutrition, what changes in the cell are they? Are there? How are they stabilized? How are they regulated? Could begin to make contact with the people who are working within the Mendelian tradition.
What is the debt that molecular biology, genetic engineering today owes to this French paradox that you have described?
The biggest debt is the understanding of some of the control mechanisms and the regulation mechanisms which are central now in molecular biology, because the focus on the question of what is it that controls cell fate, what is it that regulates how it changes, when it came to a meeting with the fact that there are genes that are what control what are the potentialities of the cell, allowed the teasing out of some of the mechanisms by means of which it's controlled when a gene is turned on, when it is turned off. Mm-hmm. And when you begin to have that, you begin to have control of what that cell will do.
That sounds so scientific. It sounds like computer talk, binary systems, that sort of thing. What is a philosopher doing looking at biology?
First of all, the questions you started with are very important. What sort of way is it that how do scientists get at, go for, the mm-hmm. truth? Is there such a thing as a monolithic way of getting the truth? Uh-huh. The answer to that, along the lines I'm pursuing, is no. But at the same time,
we want to believe there may be, but the answer is nonetheless no.
The answer is that there's not a monolithic way of getting there.
Uh-huh.
And at the same time, there is unquestionably an immense amount of real progress in science. We know an incredible amount more about what organisms are made of and how they work than was known a century and a half ago. Mm-hmm. So to understand the interactions, the kinds of interactions, the value of the different ways of going at, trying to find that sort of thing out, is, I think, of great philosophical importance, not necessarily only to give practical advice, and indeed I'm not sure I ever will be able to do that, mm-hmm. but to have a fairly reasonable understanding of what our knowledge is like, how do we evaluate it, where it comes from.
Do you think, Dick Burian, that the scientists, the pure scientists, the one who are doing the, whether it's applied or theoretical, do they resent people like you, the philosophers, the historians of science who come along and pick and gadfly and comment? Tell me about that interplay between you and them.
I've actually been quite amazed. I've given a number of talks at scientific congresses now, and there's immense interest in some circles. Most of the molecular biologists today are, after all, in the end, bench workers, and they don't care much about that history. But almost everyone who's interested in fundamental problems wants to know, are there leads that I've missed? How do other people work? Where do I fit in the larger picture? And wants to make their place in history. So they care about what others think in the way that a philosopher or historian
Let's hope so. Dick Burian, I want to thank you for your time on Soundings. I also want to give credit here to your collaborators. You are one of three people working on this project called Handling Heredity. Tell me very briefly who they are.
My colleague in Blacksburg, Virginia, at Virginia Polytech, is Doris Zallin. Mm-hmm. She has been a geneticist. Worked in fact, she also works advising the NIH on human gene experimentation projects, and has become a historian of genetics, working with me, mm-hmm. And helps immensely in my weak understanding of some of the technical aspects of the work.
And your French colleague?
And let me say also that Doris also knows quite a lot of institutional history. My French colleague is a philosopher with the equivalent of a master's degree in biology. His name uh-huh. is Jean Gaillon. He teaches at the University of Burgundy in Dijon. And he has written a 1,000-page thesis on the reception of Darwin, and works very closely on very much the same topics that I do. We ran into each other and discovered the topics together, really, and built this collaboration out of that discovery.
Well, again, Richard Burian, thank you for your time here on Soundings. Your project is Handling Heredity. You're a professor at Virginia Polytech Institute. What's the proper name these days? Virginia Polytechnic?
Institute and State University. I once went to a conference, and the name badges at the conference had 5 different ways of calling the institution.
I wish you well in your work, Dick. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Soundings, a weekly magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like a cassette copy of this week's show. The speakers were Thomas Malone of North Carolina State University and the Sigma Xi Center, and Richard Burian of Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University. Send $5 for a cassette copy of this program or $2 for a Soundings catalog. This week, it's program number 631. Write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. That's number 631, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. We welcome your comments and suggestions. Next week, American Social Manners. Patricia Meyer Spax of the University of Virginia will talk about her study of boredom and culture. Richard Bushman of Columbia University will talk about his new book, The Refinement of America, A History of Social Mores in the United States. Major funding for this program came from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Until next week at this time on this radio station, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Science and Society, this week on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Thomas Malone of North Carolina State University provides an optimistic overview of Earth Summit 92, the world's first environmental conference. Richard Burian of VPI discusses French culture and the practice of genetics. Science and Society, some answers and insights this week on Soundings.